This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening all over the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I'm here to be the managing partner of your life. And I'm not here alone. It's been really great the last few weeks because I got to tell you, for those of you who have been listening, and I know there's a lot of you out there, you know that Carrie Kasem has departed. She has left us. She's moving on to greener pastures, actually. Hopefully, she'll move to Florida or be bi-coastal or something. We miss Carrie. But I've had an opportunity to have some guest hosts with me here in studio. A few weeks ago, we had Deb Carson on, who is a Fox Sports analyst and a Fox Sports announcer. And that was fun. And then last week, we had Jillian Barbary. We had fun with Jillian. I was out in the desert driving back, trying to get here in studio in time to talk with Jillian, and I did. We had fun with that. And today we have another one of my favorite guest hosts who has hosted and been a guest on this show over the last couple of years, Troy Slayton. Last we saw of Troy, he was a candidate for the L.A. Superior Court. He is a lawyer, partner at Floyd Skirin, Manoukian, and Langevin. He's a media pundit, always on Fox, CNN, HLN, CBS, NBC. Doesn't care. He'll go on anywhere as proof that he's here on Gervie's Law. And he's a famous actor, at least as a child actor. It's really an honor to have Troy Slayton sitting beside me today. And we're more than 6 feet, aren't we?
I'd say we're about 9 feet apart from each other.
Nine and a half.
It is so great to be here with you, Alan.
It's nice to have you. And you know why he says that it's great to be here? Because he actually hasn't been out of the house for the last 8 months.
No, I've been like a hermit. This is the first time I think that I've been inside an office-like or studio setting since the pandemic.
Right.
I've done all my appearances on Zoom and online. I haven't done anything like Jeffrey Toobin. So all my appearances have been on Zoom.
Yeah, you got to keep your hands where people see it when you're on Zoom. But,
yes.
And I can make fun of Jeffrey Toobin because he really wasn't that nice. We tried to get him on the show a little while ago, and I guess it was, but he kind of gave us an email saying, no, thank you, but good luck to you. And I should have said, you know what, good luck to you. I hope that you survive this little controversy here.
Well, you know... It teaches everyone a lesson.
Well, I don't know about everyone. A lot of us actually are on Zoom calls without doing anything that we are embarrassed about.
I can admit I've done depositions where I've been dressed up in a suit on top and then in shorts or my underwear.
Right. I don't want to hear about it.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's the truth. You just got to be careful not to stand up.
Yeah, no, I've stood up and I'm very proud of it when I stand up. I have nothing to be embarrassed about. But let's talk about something other than Jeffrey Toobin because, you know, again, he didn't come on the show. So I'm good luck to him. But next time, Jeff, accept your invite to be on the show, and I won't trash you.
He's taking time off for personal reasons.
Yeah, personal reasons. Well, I don't know what he's taking, what he's getting off. I don't really know when he is and when he isn't, but not our business. Let's talk a little bit before. Oh, well, first of all, let's talk about the show because this is going to be a fun show.
This is exciting.
And Troy, I'm glad you're here to share. Madeline Westerhout is going to be on the show after the break. And for those of you who don't know, she was President Trump's personal secretary, and she was the director of the Oval Office operations, very close to President Trump. And she's just written a book called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, How I Lost It and What I Learned. So we're going to talk about
that. Was like the gatekeeper inside of the Oval Office. She decided who got to get in and to see the president.
Yeah, and then she got fired. I'm going to ask her if he pointed his finger at her and said, you're fired. She still loves him. The book is a great read if for anyone who can stand it. I would really suggest you read it because it is really interesting to be behind the scenes. And I admire people who do read it, even if they're not Republicans or they're not Trump supporters, because it shows that willingness to say, hey, let me see another person's perspective.
Whether you're a Trump supporter or not, everybody loves the palace intrigue. That's everybody right. loves to see what's going on behind the walls.
Yeah.
Same thing in with the UK, with the royal family. The president and the presidency is the closest thing we have to a monarchy and a royal family here in the United States.
Well, I beg to differ, though, Troy, because I do want to have a little controversy. I don't want to just, you know, you and I just butting up here. I don't think that everyone is interested. There are so many people who just they hear the name Trump and they want to do nothing, have nothing to do with it. They don't want to give him a chance. They don't want to listen. They don't want to know anything.
But I think even people that don't like him love the scandal. They love the voyeurism. Everybody wants to know something that's going on inside, some sort of scandal.
Only if it fits within their way of thinking. You know, but later in the show, we're going to have Carl Hoffman on. He's going to have a different perspective because he just wrote a book called Liar's Circus, A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies. So that's a real difference from, I think, what we're going to hear from Madeline.
He's a really interesting guy. He's a person who's the opposite of a Trump supporter, who made himself seem like a Trump supporter to get into the world of the MAGA rallies and with the Trump supporters that are there. So that's going to be really interesting to talk to him.
We're going to do a juxtaposition today because we'll start off and hear how great Trump is, and then later on we'll hear maybe he isn't so great.
It's a very fair and balanced show that you have today, Alan.
Fair and balanced. Isn't that one of the Fox taglines?
I wouldn't know because that's a different network.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's KBC.
We wouldn't talk about that today.
You know, but I do want to ask you something because we were talking briefly. Tell us what it's like. You're a family man. You're a very skilled lawyer, but, you know, you have a couple kids who are out of school right now in remote learning. And you're looking good. It seems like you're not as stressed. Like, I mean, look at me. I look like hell. Looks like, you know, I've had a tough time with, you know, dealing with this. What about you?
Well, I haven't had a haircut in months. Yeah, it looks like either. Both of us, you know, are looking a little scraggly around the edges. But no, my kids are adapting. They're doing it as best they can. They miss their friends. I think my son has become an expert in the world of Fortnite since the pandemic. But I think they're looking forward to getting back to real school. But I think they're adapting as well as,
you know,
as anyone can.
It's funny you talk about Fortnite because I have tried to avoid that. My kids are 6 and 7, and they have been watching. Today, this afternoon, they had baseball tryouts, and they came back, and they watched, like, marathon of The Brady Bunch, Bewitched, Batman, The Munsters,
great.
Like all of those old shows. And, you know, Nancy's not happy with me. She's like, can't they just be in this century? And I'm like, anything to avoid having them sit with their iPads and deal with Fortnite.
All those shows are beautiful. They are wonderful. That is the thing that you should be doing. I try and get my kids to watch Svengoolie with me on Saturday nights, the old, you know, horror movie marathons. And I think that watching all that old stuff is great. My daughter is making Spinal Tap references, and I was just going over with our mutual friend James Torme.
Of course.
I was discussing with him just yesterday and today what movies I need to show my 13-year-old daughter to bring her into the pop culture of our time.
That's
and
right.
He gave me movies like Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Lost Boys, License to Drive, Back to the Future, Stand By Me, Lucas, The Lonely Guy, Fletch.
Those these are great movies.
All these movies that we need to, he says, and eventually play it again, Sam.
Yeah.
Eventually we'll get her into Woody Allen.
My kids aren't old enough. But we're going to take a break now. And after the break, we're going to welcome Madeline Westerhout, President Trump's former first lady.
It's exciting.
Not first lady, secretary, assistant,
gatekeeper,
director of the Oval Office Operations. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Yes, we are back. I am Alan Gervey, and there are two lawyers here today, not just me. Usually it was just Carrie Kasem, who was not a lawyer.
But still a very nice person.
Of course. I love Carrie. But let's not talk about it. Let's talk about Troy. Troy Slayton is with me, and he is guest hosting, which thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here as always.
And I know you are interested in our first guest. And I don't mean, you know, in that way, but you're interested because the book is a really great read. And the book is called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, How I Lost It and What I Learned. She's the former director of Oval Office Operations. She was President Trump's executive assistant. She was really involved with the RNC for a while, and she worked with a number of different politicians getting the gig. And the book is really something because it brings a new perspective to what a lot of people just don't want to hear. Madeline Westerhout, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. We like to have, you know, Californians. Now, you grew up here, and it's nice to know that, you know, you did go back east and you spent some time there in Washington. How did you get involved that you would become this person who was shoulder to shoulder with the president? Like, no one can say that. Well, maybe Monica Lewinsky can say it, but...
Oh, goodness.
But, you know, you
don't compare Madeline to Monica.
Well, you know, the funny thing is if you watch Madeline's interview, she comports herself so well, the maturity and the dignity that she has. So, yes, it's just the fact that you spent a lot of time with the president. How did it happen, Madeline?
Oh, goodness. So I would love to say that it was like this great calculated plan and this great political mind. And honestly, it was just being in the right place at the right time and working really hard. I was really young when I went to the White House. I was 25 years old, 26 years old. And I had been working at the Republican National Committee for 4 years. And then Donald Trump won the election. And
you started working on the transition team, right?
I did. I went up to New York City and I spent some time in New York on the transition team. And the president's longtime assistant from the Trump organization was not going to join him at the White House, and he needed a new assistant. And I kind of, like I said, was in the right place at the right time and was offered the job. Honestly, had no idea what I was getting myself into. But my boss at the RNC asked me one day if I had any interest in sitting outside of the Oval Office. And I think the answer to that question is always yes.
Was your boss, is that Reince Priebus at the time?
It was Katie Walsh, but she was Reince Priebus's chief of staff. And so it was Reince, Jared Kushner, and Steve Bannon that kind of recommended me for this position.
But isn't it true that President Trump actually saw you and liked what he saw and asked, you know, hey, can we get Madeline in with us?
So what I was doing in Trump Tower that he saw and liked, but I was escorting people into Trump Tower, everyone that was coming into an interview with him, whether they were coming in, you know, for an interview for a cabinet secretary position or just to meet with the president-elect, I brought them through the lobby of Trump Tower, and there was always a press pool in the lobby. And I escorted them in because I didn't want them to get lost in the hustle and bustle of New York City. And the president was literally watching, a president-elect was literally watching TV one day and said, whoever this girl is, I appreciate that she is bringing my guests in and taking good care of them. Let's keep doing that. Let's go to Mar-a-Lago, and she can do that there, and Bedminster. And so I did catch his eye there because I was taking good care of the people that were coming in to meet with him.
So let's talk about you being inside the White House, though. That's what everybody wants to know. What's it like in the Oval Office? You're the gatekeeper.
You're just outside the Oval Office.
Right outside the Oval Office. You're like air traffic control.
Yes, absolutely. And so for anyone that has ever watched the show The West Wing, you know, I think the closest character that I can compare myself to is Mrs. Lanningham. But yeah, I was the gatekeeper to the Oval Office. And so everyone that walked in to meet with the president had to come through my desk. And so... I was able to meet everyone that came in to the White House and come in to meet with the president. And it's so funny because while I was there, my family would constantly call or text me and say, you know, we hear it's so chaotic there and we're worried about you and are you okay? And I'm like, you guys, it's fine. There's no chaos. It's pretty busy. We're working really, really hard, but it is not that chaotic tense atmosphere that gets portrayed. It was the president really is very aware that he has a limited amount of time to do what he needs to do to make the lives of the American people better. And so he never stopped working. And so for the 2.5 years that I was there, I never stopped working.
You know, it's interesting because you bring that up, that it's depicted so differently in the media. And President Trump really appreciated your book, Off the Record, saying in his tweet that you're a very smart and wise young woman who wrote an honest depiction of what really went on in the White House versus what people speculate about. When you hear that, how does it make you feel knowing that, and we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, you're not there anymore, but apparently the president really appreciates what you've written in Off the Record?
Well, I was so thankful that he was supportive of the book. And I told him about the book when the press release first came out. And, you know, there have been so many books written about this president and this administration. And the last thing that I wanted to do was be another person who writes another book. And so when I told the president that I was writing a book, I told him I was going to tell the truth. And my truth is that I had an amazing experience working for him. And I really admire him. I think he's doing a good job for this country. And he knew he had nothing to worry about with what I had to say, because I had the best time ever working for him.
Did you talk with the president about the book, that you were going to be releasing a book since you were let go from the White House?
I didn't speak with him until the book was pretty much finished. I let him know right before my press release came out. So before it went public, I called him to make him aware of it. And then a couple of days before the book was published, I called him to let him know a couple of little details of the book. But no, I didn't really, you know, collaborate with anyone. It was really important
for me
just to...
Madeline, you say you called him, but isn't there like a gatekeeper who stops people from just calling him? Or were you able to just call him? Do you have his number?
Oh, gosh, no. I called the old me.
The old
or,
you?
Or one of his,
the new you.
Yes, the new me. One of his aides. And I just said, you know, if the president has a few minutes, I'd love to speak with him. And he would get me back either in a couple hours or the next day.
And were those people who you have, you know, obviously contacts with, were they there when you were there? And did you have relationships with these people so you kind of can talk to whoever you need to?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that, you know, I feel so fortunate to have, having worked in the White House and building these really close friendships with a lot of the people that I worked with, because we were there, honestly, more time than we were at home. And so you can't help but get close with these people. And a lot of the people that I worked with, I still have very good relationships with and talk to often, and was able to kind of call a couple of people that I am still close with and let them know that I wanted to speak with the president if he would take my call when he was available.
That is so cool. Everybody wants to know. Everyone's got palace intrigue. Everyone wants to know about all the cool stuff that's like around the Oval Office. Are there secret tunnels that you got to go into? Did you get to go into a private dining room off the Oval Office? Does the chief of staff have his office right next to it where he just pops in all the time? Tell us something.
Warm cookies there all the time.
Could you go into the mess hall and just get whatever you want?
So the thing about the West Wing that I think everyone comments on when they walk into it is that it is so much smaller, and same with the Oval Office, than they would have imagined. And it's also very confusing. There's tons of hallways. The Oval Office itself has 4 points of entry. And so, you know, the office, the West Wing is pretty confusing. And so for the first couple weeks that I was there, I was just trying to find my way around. And, you know, honestly, I was just, you know, wanted to know where the restroom was or where the mess was. But there's a Navy mess, which is where the staff gets to eat. And there's a beautiful dining room where you can go and sit and have lunch. I never really had time to do that. So I would always get my food from the takeout window and bring it back to my desk and eat it at my desk. But the president has a dining room off of the Oval Office, which is where he spends any time that he is not in a meeting or surrounded by people. He loves to just kind of be back in the dining room and watching the news or catching up on paperwork and reading the newspaper. But yeah, it is just really an incredible place, and the artwork and the history behind it. You know, you walk into the cabinet room and
yeah,
there's portraits of, of past presidents, and you just think about everything that has happened in every single one of those rooms.
So much of the media tries to portray this image of the president as someone who just sits around and, you know, watches cable news all day long
and tweets
at what he's seen on cable news and takes these long naps of executive time. And is there truth to that, or is that just hogwash?
Well, the book certainly suggests there isn't truth to that.
Absolutely. And honestly, I have never met anyone who works as hard as this president. And like I said before, he is acutely aware of the fact that he has a very limited amount of time to work on behalf of the American people. And he was running circles around most of the staff in the West Wing, and he's in his mid-70s or early 70s, and he had more energy than pretty much anyone I've ever met. And it was absolutely amazing.
And
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, like, yes, of course, he has to catch up on the news and read the newspaper. And yes, he loves to tweet, but he is constantly working.
And you talk about that when you say about his reading, that it's really just not a truth to say that he, like Troy says, that he's just watching TV and tweeting, that he's really reading, and he has the knowledge, which people don't want to give him credit for. But when you talk about the tweets, you do talk about the fact that, you know, you were involved in some of them. Some of them you didn't really like, but you did manage to deal with the tweets.
Sure. And look, I think it's pretty fair to say that not everyone loves every single tweet the president has ever put out. I watched an interview that he did a couple months ago, and he admits there were a few that he thought he could have done without. And so, there were a couple of times where I was like, oof, sir, are you sure you want to say that? But I never tried to stop him from tweeting. You know, he's the commander in chief. And when he
decides, wait a second, did you actually say to him, are you sure you want to tweet that? And did he look at you and say, yes, Madeline, or it's none of your business, I'm going to tweet whatever I want to tweet?
There were definitely certain times where a group of us would be in the Oval Office or the dining room, and the president would, you know, have a brilliant idea for a tweet. And we would say, sir, I think we can wait on that one, or let's see how it plays out. And and sometimes he said, put it out, I don't care what you say. And sometimes he said, you know, I think I can wait, you know, an hour or so.
When he said put it out, does that mean that others are tweeting for him, or was he doing it himself?
So every single tweet that the president puts out on his Twitter account is from him. He's not, you know, he doesn't have his phone in the Oval Office because it's a SCIF. So the Oval Office, you can't have any electronics in the Oval Office for security purposes. So when he was in the Oval Office, he would call myself or Dan Scavino or any member of staff, and he would dictate tweets to us. And so maybe while it wasn't him pressing, you know, typing out on his phone and pressing the key, every single tweet.
Does the president have an iPhone or Android, or is it some sort of special presidential telephonic device?
He has an iPhone. Yep, he has an iPhone, and the White House provided it. And so he has that in his residence with him, and he takes it on the road with him. And so,
you know, Madeline, you could have edited. We had to take a break, but you could have edited some of these tweets. You didn't have to do it just the way he said it. You know that?
Oh, well, for every tweet that went out, think about the ones that didn't go out.
That's a good answer. All right, we're going to take a break. We got to get to your firing, and I know that's it's kind of an interesting story, and we're going to talk about that after the break. We're talking to Madeline Westerhout. The book is called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, and How I Lost It and What I Learned. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
The glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC. Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, we're back. I'm Alan Gervie. I'm here with Troy Slayton, and we are talking to Madeline Westerhout. The book is called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, How I Lost It and What I Learned. We're going to talk about how she lost it and what she learned. And by the way, if you're watching the Dodger game, don't watch. You don't need to. Just wait till the ninth inning. Everything's going to happen in the ninth inning. And if you're not watching, don't turn it on yet, because things will change. Whatever's happening now, and I'm not going to let you know because I'm watching it here in the studio, but everything will change in the ninth inning. And I feel I can say that with Madeline because she is from Southern California, so she's probably a Dodger fan, right, Madeline?
I have to admit, I'm a Los Angeles Angels fan, and I still believe that they're really the Anaheim Angels.
Yes, me
too. Well, that's because you're from OC. When we say you're from SoCal, you're an OC girl, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, but I bring it all together. You know, there's so much that you talk about in the book, and you talk about the deep admiration that President Trump has for women and the respect for women. How do you feel when you see in your mind that he is being mischaracterized by the media and by a lot of people who I'm certain are not friends with you? How does that make you feel when you've actually experienced that respect and admiration?
It's heartbreaking, but I understand it because that was me before I got to know him. I believed everything I heard on the media, on the news, watching television. You know, obviously they do not portray him well, and I believed it all. And so while I do not believe what is being said about him, because I know him so well, I understand why people feel that way.
Would you be the one telling somebody that they could or could not get into the Oval Office to meet with him? Or was everyone that's coming to your point, they had already had an appointment, they were set to meet with him? Did you have to, like, say to some people, break it to them, I'm sorry, the president's just out of time and he's not going to be able to meet with you, senator, or whoever was there at your desk?
So most of the time, the people that made it to my desk had an appointment. But there were some times when staff would just pop in and ask if he had any time. And the president would make time for anyone and everyone. But there were of course, occasions when it just wasn't possible. And so, yes, it did fall on me to be the bearer of bad news and let whether it be the vice president or a cabinet secretary or a member of the senior staff,
the vice
know
president.
That the president did not have time for him.
Oh, would you say, I'm sorry, Mr. Vice President, the president is just can't talk to you right now.
He just used you to get elected, but he's not interested in talking to you.
No, that honestly happened very rarely. The only times I would tell the vice president no was if the president was in either with private attorneys or in with his family. The vice president pretty much had free reign of the Oval, but there were times when I think the president needed to have that, you know, either alone time.
So, were you ever inside in there when there was important decisions being made? Were you there during like any kind of presidential daily briefing, or were you in the Situation Room or anything like that where some really crazy stuff was going down?
So the president's intelligence briefings were kept really, really tight, and so I was never in those. But there were definitely times when I was in the room with decisions were being made. And I talk about this in my book, but there was one time when it was late at night. And for some reason, the West Wing was very quiet and the president called me in and I helped him with a letter or a statement rather that he put out after Jamal Khashoggi was killed.
Right.
And so he put out a statement about that. And I was the one that helped him write that and that, you know, typed it up and everything. And so, yeah, I was very fortunate to be there for some really interesting moments.
Madeline, we're going to get into what happened that caused the firing. But before we do, you know, you got to give us something here. Who got really angry? Like, did Schumer or Pelosi, did they start yelling at you when you wouldn't let them in? Or, like, give us something like you gave the reporters when you had a... Have you had a couple drinks tonight, first of all?
No, I have not.
Oh, no. The specific instructions before the interview, have a couple of drinks so we can talk about this.
We're not going to get the real story now.
That didn't get passed on to me.
Oh, no. So do you have any, even though I know it'll be tough to do and you really have learned your lesson and you take responsibility, that is something I admire in a human being so much. You have no idea. I run a law firm and the people in my law firm will never take responsibilities for mistakes. You do, but Here, make another mistake. Who really pissed you off? Who got angry with you? Who was rude to you?
Who was rude to me? You know, honestly, I was in a position where I was the one that was going to be giving people access to the president. So pretty much everyone was nice to me.
All right. So
let's talk about how much you hate reporters now.
Yeah. Let's talk about the situation. We've got another 5 minutes with you. So we'll get through this. Tell us what happened on that fateful night where you had the dinner with the reporters and what you said and how it affected President Trump's finger when he pointed at you and said you're fired.
You've got a night off. And some reporters invite you out, and what happens next?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were finishing up a 10-day trip at the president's property in Bedminster, New Jersey, and I was taking advantage of a day off. I was laying by the pool. I had had a couple of drinks, and I was invited to an off-the-record dinner with some reporters and a colleague of mine. And, you know, for some reason that night, I accepted the invitation. I went to the dinner. I kept drinking, and I said some things I never should have said and that I didn't mean. And what I said, what I allegedly said, you know, lots of twists and turns, but it got back to the chief of staff and the president, and they asked me to resign, which, of course,
they say that you said some not nice things about Tiffany Trump. Is that right?
So I definitely made comments about the president's family, and this is not an excuse at all. But in my mind, with those reporters, you know, they've spoken to several senior staff who give them policy and political stuff all the time. And at that dinner, they had the president's executive assistant who knows the family and knows him personally. And so they wanted some juicy details. And I was trying to humanize the family. That doesn't excuse it at all. I said some things about the children.
Did you say that you were closer to the president than his daughters?
You know, I don't recall saying that, but I take responsibility for everything that was reported I said, whether I said it or not.
You know, one of the things that shows the president's respect for you is that he basically forgave you right away after he let you go. And by the way, did he bring you into a conference room and point at you and say you're fired? How did that go down?
Or was it the chief of staff?
So I actually was in California.
The chief of staff didn't have a television show called The Apprentice. Troy, get with the program.
I want to know.
I was actually in California at the time, and so this was all done via phone call. And
it wasn't done by a tweet, though.
No, thank God.
Well, you could have edited the tweet, Madeline.
And I said, you're not fired.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's funny. For someone who has kind of built a brand on the term you're fired, the president doesn't actually love that confrontation. The chief of staff called me and he said, you know, I'm going to have to ask you to resign. And the president is on board with this decision. And I was able to speak to the president the next day and I apologized. And like you said, yes, he forgave me, which was very humbling, and I appreciated that very much.
But you didn't forgive the reporters. How do you feel about them? Off-the-record discussions, and it takes away your dream job.
I think the biggest thing is that I take responsibility. I think, you know, the other question is, what does off-the-record even mean anymore?
There is exactly. It's no such thing.
Exactly.
Right.
And the frustrating part about me leaving was that people said to me, or, you know, in tweets and on social media, sort of, that you should have known better and you should have known that there's nothing that is off the record. And I think that's a really sad state of affairs for journalism, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I think that it's too bad, because obviously you were respecting others. They weren't respecting you. So where do we've got another minute.
But Alan, you know, it wasn't even those reporters who broke her trust, really. It was those reporters spoke to other reporters. They spoke to their friends and said things about what happened at that dinner. And they're the ones who reported it.
But that's still irresponsible for those reporters to talk about it. I'm sorry for being your attorney here, Madeline, but I'm defending you. I really think that, the way it all went down, whoever said it, it should not have been put into the public. But let's talk now We've answered. We had this question out there. Who is Madeline voting for? And I think you've answered. You don't even have to say it. Because while you didn't vote for President Trump in 2016 and you didn't vote for Clinton, of course, but you didn't vote for Trump, you will, if you haven't already cast your ballot for President Trump this time.
100%. I just changed my voter registration back to California, and I am so excited to walk into the polling, the voting booth, and I'm going to vote in person because I don't trust the mail-in ballots.
Wow. You know, he's going to
cast my vote for President Trump.
He's, I think, going to tweet out again, as he did before, go buy this book. It's a job well done. I think he will be happy to support your book. We want to tell everyone about the book before we let you go, and also what you're doing now. I mean, you sound like you can use this experience, and you've learned so much from it, and you can really move on it and maybe a political career. What do you think?
I think the political career is behind me. I had the greatest job in politics, and I am very happy to close out that chapter. But I'm back home in California, and I have some exciting ideas. But the past couple months, I have just been trying to, you know, speak about my book, and especially before the election, just share with the American people the man that I got to know, the man behind the president.
And the book is called Off the Record, My Dream Job at the White House, How I Lost It and What I Learned. It's a great read. Everyone should pick it up. We want to thank you, Madeline, for being on Gervie's Law today. It's really been a great time sitting with you here and hearing you. And we wish you all the luck.
We do. What a great experience that you had. And thank you for sharing the intrigue of what goes on behind the curtain. Everyone should go out and buy Madeline's book.
Yeah. Whether you're Republican or Democrat. Okay, take care. Go watch the Dodgers win. It's not the Angels, but it's better than nothing. All right, we're going to take a break. I'm Alan Gervie. He's Troy Slayton. This is Gervie's Law. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We are back. I'm Alan Gervie. He is Troy Slayton. And we are going to welcome to Gervie's Law. This is a really great book. Just as we talked about Madeline Westerhout's book, if you want to hear another side to what's going on in this country, best-selling author Carl Hoffman has written a book called Liar's Circus, A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside-Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies. He is a former contributing editor to National Geographic's Traveler and Wired. As I said, New York Times best-selling author. Savage Harvest came out a few years ago. He's traveled to over 80 countries as a travel writer, has a lot of credentials, and then he goes out and he goes to all of these 5,000 miles of the American heartland to these rallies.
Undercover.
He interviews people, talks to people, and he writes an incredible book getting into the psychology and the sociology of these Trump supporters. Carl Hoffman, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
So, Carl, I got to ask you, what made you do this? Were you just so pissed off you just wanted to find out what the heck is going on at these rallies?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, I'm a journalist, and I've been covering the world for decades, and most of it has been in, you know, some of the furthest, craziest corners of the world. And suddenly last year, it sort of hit me that I live in Washington, D.C., and that, you know, 63 million people had voted for Donald Trump, but I didn't know any of them. And you know what?
Carl, I got to say, we live in California, in Southern California, so we don't know any of them either. But go ahead.
Well, you know, I mean, bars, restaurants, gyms, whatever. I mean, I didn't meet any. And there were all these people out there. And then you see that Trump had more rallies than any other president in history. And the rallies were sort of this key component of his power and his presidency. And I sort of was thinking about it, and it suddenly occurred to me that, you know, if Trump Land was a place, it was at his rallies. And if it was a place, then I could go there. And that was what I did. That
and
was my job.
So suddenly you're
I
there.
I took off and I went.
Suddenly you're there in front of 25,000 Trump supporters, and you are like the blueberry in the tomato soup.
Well, you know, it first, that's how very much how it was. You know, my first rally was in Minneapolis, and then I went to Dallas, and I was really, really lost at those events. You know, I was.
But what was the commonality?
Rolled over. You know, shocked. I mean, there was no. I was a completely an outsider in every way, and I was sort of having this existential crisis. I mean, you know, texting my friends and my kids, and so in this sort of upside down world. But then I really wanted to go deep, and in my third rally, which was in Tupelo, Mississippi, I got there like 54 hours before showtime. And I was sixth in line, and I plunked my camp chair down, and I'd met a few guys at the front of the line, sort of the super Trump super fans in Dallas. And I put my chair down, and I became one of them. And from then on, I was kind of among the merry band of Trumpians going from rally to rally.
And what were some of the commonalities that you saw there at the Trump rally, at the Trump rallies?
Well, I mean, it's a crazy world. I mean, it's this sort of totally upside down place. It's the arena where everything that Trump is and says kind of comes together. I mean, on the one hand, it's this. I think the rallies are this sort of vital visiting place, a point of incredible social connection in an era when, for a lot of people, especially rural Americans, you know, white working class rural Americans, those social connections are fraying. You know, on the one hand, on the other hand, it's this place where, you know, I kept thinking of a professional wrestling match in a way, like, you know, a boxing match is. People could go 12 rounds and it would be points only. And a wrestling match is so much better. I mean, you know, people are jumping off the ropes and hitting each other with folding chairs. And that's sort of what the Trump arena is. And it's this place where, you know, union support, you know, the GOP supports unions, even though it's been, you know, passing right to work laws, decimating unions for years, where, you know, the GOP support, where Trump will always support your right to have insurance that'll cover pre-existing conditions, even as he's suing to have the Affordable Care Act, you know, thrown out. So it's just those sort of absolute upside down kind of absurdities. Or you're in this place with, you know, the song that people, you know, crazy loud music, really, really, you know, and you can, a lot of people wear earplugs. It's so loud. And, you know, the song that gets people going the most is always YMCA, you know, Village People's YMCA. And you'll be at like in a place like Mississippi where there'll be, you know, thousands upon thousands of, you know, of evangelicals who, you know, think that being gay is a sin. And, you know, they're all dancing and swaying to the Village People.
But just yesterday, I watched a Trump rally on TV yesterday, and there were two nuns behind the president, and they were both dancing to YMCA when Donald Trump was also dancing, who looked a little bit like Elaine from Seinfeld.
Yeah, I mean, that's the crazy thing. That sort of shows you what the absurdity of the whole thing, and that, you know, the title of my book is Liar's Circus, because I think, you know, Trump gets up there and you're, you know, it was shocking to me, really, the first time I saw him, how powerful and big he seemed. He's a big man and he looks strong and he's very relaxed and he's a tremendous speaker and he'll say anything. You know, the first time I saw him, I just thought this man will say anything.
But after
he's unrepentant.
After all these experiences, though, you weren't shocked anymore. I mean, one of the important things is that you really point out the reality of it. You can call it absurd and you can call it upside down, but there's really a reality that these people exist and that they really believe in what they are experiencing.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, I traveled a lot of miles and I became friends with these people, a lot of them. And, you know, I mean, a lot of them were very nice people, and I'm friends with them to this day. And they're, you know, Trump, their love of Trump, which is absurd to me, is also in response to, you know, some really powerful things that are going on in this country. I mean, a lot of, you know, profound kind of systemic changes in work and loss of a lot of manufacturing jobs and changes in gender and gender identity and all of those things that are really leaving a lot of, in particular, white working class men with a sense of vertigo. And then Trump comes along and says whatever he wants to say, that he'll solve all those problems and he's going to make them winning, winning, winning. And so people love him. I mean, you know, people say he will call him heaven sent, or in the middle of a rally, there'll be a momentary pause and a very gruff, you know, voice will call out, "I love you."
But doesn't that just underscore how different everyone in this country really is? There's relativism. There's no absolutism here. And isn't that something that you kind of just became accepting of, even though you couldn't fathom why people would think that way?
Well, I felt a lot of, you know, commonalities in a way. Like, you know, people talk about flyover country, or will say, how could you have done what you did? Weren't you frightened? And the answer for me, I mean, it helps that I'm a white male, but no, you know, I thought there was a lot of commonalities, but
interesting.
You know, I mean, we're all sort of Americans, but they're caught up in this bubble world in which, for instance, they don't read the news. You know,
Is it a bubble world because it's what you don't agree with? Is it a bubble world because they have a truth that's their truth that's different than yours?
Well, I would argue that that's not, in fact, true, that there is truth, and that we can figure out what the truth is, and that what they believe, for the most part, is not true. I mean, take QAnon, for example. I mean, you know, QAnon is just this crazy, it's the craziest, most baseless conspiracy theory you can imagine. And, you know, going into this project, I would have said that, you know, things like QAnon were fringe theories. But in my experience, that's not true, and that almost every supporter of Trump at a Trump rally believes in some level of conspiracy theory. I mean, that Michelle Obama is a man, and that, you know, Hillary Clinton and John Podesta are raping babies and drinking their, you know, draining their fluids.
Wow.
And, you know, just the craziest thing.
But you found everyone to be nice, to be polite.
Not everyone. But
you found the people there at the rallies.
We only have a minute, Troy. You can't talk about everyone. But you can address that. And it's really interesting.
Many people.
Yeah.
Many people.
So, Carl, with the last minute, let's talk about, I mean, I assume you felt it was worth it. It's a great book. It's called Liar's Circus, A Strange and Terrifying Journey into the Upside Down World of Trump's MAGA Rallies. Everyone should take a read because it's enlightening. Who's going to win the election? Does he have enough support from these people to win or not?
Well, I always hesitate to say, but I think Biden's going to win in a landslide.
All right. Well, that tells us something. Carl Hoffman,
we will see.
Want to thank you for being on Gervie's Law with us today.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Take it easy. Troy Slayton, bye-bye. Thanks for being on. Bye.
Thank you, Alan Gervie. Thanks for having me. I hope to be back soon.
We'll have you back.
Thank you.
See you next week.
Glass is always half full when you're listening to Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
This show is furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.